The last video about Sanguinius consumed my mind for pretty much the whole of last month, and so I wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to speak to next. Return to contemporary 40k, something Xenos, human level at Necromunda or such. All good ideas that I will definitely do, but I hope it's not disappointing that I decided to stay right in the Heresy. Because one thought I've often considered is how some of the traitor legions really came out of the Heresy badly, and then consequently how did this place them in M41, not just in terms of their objective losses strategically, but in what they gained for their trouble out of the Heresy. Now sure, they may have a foot in the warp and theoretically able to access the ungodly benefits that may see them survive for many thousands of years, but at the same time, was it really what so many of them signed up for? To face a permanent struggle against a defiant Imperium, with the somewhat unreliable support of gods who seem most often barely aware of their existence? I think some of the traitors certainly felt a little hard done by, whereas others like Fabius Biles seem to not care particularly one way or the other, because they're just doing their own thing now. The Heresy is always remembered rightly as this devastating civil war, but it's mainly from the Imperial perspective. The focus tends to be on human history and how it reshaped the Imperium of Man and the Emperor's vision for human civilization. And generally speaking, we know how it goes with the Loyalists. Despite emerging victorious from the final siege upon Terra, they lost vast amounts of their war machine. Primarchs and heroes alike lay dead, lost or twisted by the nature of chaos. The traitor legions, who had seemed so readily poised to enslave the galaxy, are now in complete disarray. With Horus slain, the rebellion collapses, they've got no centralized leader or real plan as to what follows next, because they'd been so sure of victory that a contingency for defeat was never really something that was considered. So unsurprisingly, exact numbers are difficult to come by in terms of pre- and post-heresy legion registers. There are numbers which get thrown out there, but as you know, even if it's literally stated in some kind of material there, anything and all of this is little more than rough guidelines. In some records there are estimations of losses again. Generally speaking, most legions are said to have held somewhere between 70 and 150,000 marines. The Ultramarines were known to have far more. Sometimes this talks about it being potentially in the region of 250,000 Marines. This is all pre-heresy. Now, battles of this era were so extremely bloody because Astartes fighting Astartes tends to go that way. Most often the Space Marines during the Crusade were fighting ramshackle planets which had potentially some crazy technology, but it was all kind of badly put together. There wasn't much motivation, so fighting these highly coordinated superhuman tank killing machines was always going to go pretty much in the Astartes' favour. It was only when they came up against some truly organized civilizations which had sort of survived from the Dark Age of Technology that they came up against some real problems. In the battles of the Heresy, like for example during Beta Garmon and so on, the Astartes' losses on both sides were absolutely devastating, and where it was more one-sided, like the Dropsite Massacre for example, then it's estimated to have inflicted as high as 90 and 95% losses upon the Loyalists like the Iron Hands, Raven Guard and Salamanders. They're left with just remnants of their former strength. There were these various points of acute engagement which saw additional massive losses, such as Kalth, but suffice to say, any who ended up attending the Siege of Terra were left in pretty poor shape thereafter, and that's only made worse then by the scouring which followed, where enraged Loyalists pursued the traitors across the stars, driving them into the Eye of Terra, and often reducing them further into scattered warbands forced into hiding in the process. All of which is of course well established, talked about plenty of times already, common knowledge even, for those who follow the lore of 30 and 40k. So then what prompted me to make this video today is that I tend to see most discussions and comments related to the framing of the Heresy naturally focusing more on this grand sense of mutual destruction. by gosh, wasn't it big and devastating, and everybody ended up very bad on the other side, etc., that kind of thing. And of course, as we saw in the latest book in the series bearing the title Era of Ruin, this further embellishes that fact that in the immediate aftermath of the heresy, it was just as bleak as you'd imagine. There are many marines just kind of dragging themselves around through the ashes and dirt. They're not sure who is still traitor and loyalist. It's just a chaotic, bleak mess. And then we still await the scouring itself, which is confirmed, and it will be exciting to see that in more detail, which until now has remained in darkness. Essentially, it was the end of the heresy, fast forward, and then you're into apostasy and so on. Really, there was just this general sense that all had lost, been shattered and suffered in the bloody wake of the heresy. The Imperium and the Loyalists have now lost this promised future of the Emperor's vision, but they managed to cling on to Terra and claim something of a Pyrrhic victory, for whatever that's worth. And I suppose it's just morale, a sense that they would not go quietly into the night, and so on. The traitor's great gambits left them far more significantly diminished, and despite the survival of most of their Primarchs, surprisingly, they are grievously wounded. The battle and the siege has ended, so survival becomes now their priority. The long war of the coming 10,000 years finally begins. Except, within this wasteland of calamity, one of the traitor legions stands separately. That's the Wordbearers, the 17th Legion. They had entered the heresy with one of the largest traitor legions. Some estimates put this in the region of 150,000, but again, nobody can really say for sure. They also entered with a singular focus among the Legion that wasn't typical for the traitors, and that's because the Wordbearers had loyalty to the Primarch and their strength of faith being near total. They arrived also, already aligned to Chaos, and unlike their brothers, would not depart from its aftermath in ruin. Now, a side note, there were a few Wordbearers who attempted to remain loyal to the Emperor, but we're seriously talking a handful, and most were Terran-born, which was common as a marker for those of traitor legions who felt more loyalty to the Emperor than their Primarch. In the case of the Wordbearers, that connection was more deeply embedded than ever due to the zealous nature and lifestyle that existed upon Lorgar's homeworld of Colchis. Of course, most of the traitors emerged in a form that was diminished but still viable. Most retained their Primarchs, and losses were variable. I think one could argue that the more significant factor to evaluate really was their cohesion, or if they had fundamentally redefined their outlook. For example, those who are now entirely lost to the gods, like the World Eaters, Death Guard, and Emperor's Children, may have emerged with capable numbers of Astartes, yet they were now effectively entrapped, operating at the behest of the gods they now served, because no matter how they may have wished it to be otherwise, or sought to rationalise it, or even that their Primarchs twisted themselves as being anything other than enslaved to the whims of the warp, this was not so. I'm never entirely sure how to feel about the Thousand Sons when it comes to the end of the heresy. They were not really enmeshed fully with Tzeentch, and although far more sorcerous than others, I don't think it's reasonable to include them alongside those other three. They were still somewhat more independent at this specific time. Of those who pledged themselves to the Dark Gods, it was more common for them to fracture into warbands rather than retain this greater sense of unity. Some did, of course, but that same sense of structural hierarchy really ended when they fully embraced either Khorne, Nurgle, or Slaanesh. Because really, the whole purpose of becoming a traitor and following Chaos was either power or freedom from the hierarchy, discarding the Emperor's and their Primarch's oppressive shackles. Because Astartes aren't clones, they're individuals, they think for themselves, and now many held entirely opposing goals or endured their petty rivalries, such as that which continued to persist between Mortarion and Typhus. Others don't really care about freedom whatsoever, they're just addicted to this lusting drive of power that it gives them. But there are really two kinds of individuals who are seeking power. There are those who just care for it in its purest form, sort of like the World Eaters who just want to be empowered and drive and slaughter. And then there were the others, who generally speaking view chaos as something to empower themselves with more than to directly serve. These are the undivided traitors. The Night Lords had already abandoned Kurz and were just doing their own thing. The Sons of Horus entered into a period of obvious instability before becoming then the Black Legion. The Thousand Sons retreated, but were still suffering from their flesh change and eventually would become the Rubric through Ahriman's spells. Due to this, and an already established edict of minimal reliance upon Magnus as a keystone for the Legion, they would continue to function at a smaller scale. But really, they tend to operate not entirely dissimilarly from how they did pre-heresy. Although now you have them in this very bizarre state where, kind of not dissimilarly to the Necrons, you have sorcerers or cryptex commanding the undead legions of Rubric, otherwise would be Necron warriors. Then you've got the Iron Warriors and Alpha Legion. They emerge in a much better state from the heresy, despite the fact that the Lords of Siege Warfare had taken pretty substantial losses. For the Iron Warriors, it was that exact fact of their strategic mastery of siege and attrition warfare which had held them together in a structural sense post-heresy, along with the survival of their Primarch and the retention of significant manpower and material, even as they withdrew into the Eye of Terror. So from a cohesive perspective, the Iron Warriors were probably one of the more intact traitor legions post-heresy. The Alpha Legion remained typically challenging to define, in the sense that they already operated at a smaller scale in these decentralized cells, so trying to gauge their actual losses and effectiveness is more difficult than these broader legions who were just engaging in mass warfare. But one could argue the Alpha Legion probably emerged with minimal impact in the sense of their actual structure, because beyond the obvious loss of a Primarch, no matter how their material losses were impacted, their nature and their standard operating procedure ensured that they could still remain strategically effective. So whatever broad agenda they were operating under, this could likely continue. Whatever that was, of course, remains more unclear. So then we come to the Word Bearers. I argue that the Word Bearers were the singular legion who could lay any sort of plausible claim among the traitors to having emerged victorious amid the otherwise disastrous cost of the Siege of Terror and the scouring which followed. I genuinely can't look at any of the other legions and think that they really came out of it in a state that you could claim that. And so I say, perhaps controversially, did the Word Bearers emerge the overall victors of the heresy, even above the Loyalists? Because while you do have to acknowledge material losses, they sit similarly to the Alpha Legion in the sense that due to the nature of their operations, it doesn't necessarily negatively impact them if they've lost a load of individuals. Even so, their losses are still worth mentioning. Post-Kalth, that engagement alone is estimated to have cost them in the region of 50,000 Astartes, although it is said that only some 20,000 were lost in the initial engagements. The rest were dragged into the ongoing underground war on Kalth, which lasted over a decade. So it's less about material loss and more to do with the goals which were achieved and the impact they had upon all others, both before, during, and post-heresy. Because no matter the actual results from anybody keeping a score of Loyalists versus traitors on technicalities, the Word Bearers emerged from the Age of Darkness having substantially filled out their heresy bingo cards and retained most of their key named members on top of this. Their objectives were both more nuanced than most of the others, yet also more pure. While others sought largely to just overthrow the Emperor in open war and claim terror, thereby ushering in a new era of traitor rule, which would see humanity's slow descent into perpetual darkness, and those who could claim responsibility wallow in the power of the void forever, those such as Erebus and Lorgar sought more to enable the will of the powers themselves. They sought to understand the warp, to be selflessly humble before it, and to never see themselves as being above or anything more than in service to the power of the gods and the warp. Both have stated as much, with Erebus describing himself never as their champion, but their servant, their counselor, assassin, advisor, their deliverer of souls. This is the mark which divides the word-bearers and the other traitors, both undivided and blessed, because they do not even begin to imagine that they could dare to control the power of the warp, but certainly the word-bearers would allow themselves to be imbued and channel it, to live in service to the great powers, to prostrate themselves before its undeniable magnificence and its truth. But post-heresy, you only see fragments of the word-bearer's actions, and this is due to the likes of Lorgar remaining in isolation, and other agents acting in smaller groups. But I think collectively they had steadily laid the groundwork for the coming 10,000 years of Imperial decay, because their actions nearly always sought to ensure a steady stream of galactic corruption and passive environmental proselytism, which simply means conversion to the cause of chaos worship. And so while Horus and the traitor legions bled themselves against the walls of the palace, the word-bearers had, by that stage, already achieved most of their goals. They were left to look at how best they might seed further systems primed for chaos worship across the galaxy, not least because, of course, Lorgar had failed in his pitiful coup attempt to unseat Horus, who he deemed as being unworthy of the role due to Horus's refusal to submit to the great powers of the warp. And that was the wedge for one major schism in the Wordbearers in this time, because Lorgar had foreseen that Horus would fail, perish, and that the heresy would disintegrate, which saw Zardu Layak, who was a Crimson Apostle of the Wordbearers, possibly the closest to Lorgar at this period in time, now split from him, which was very unusual for the Wordbearers, and it was really one of the sort of many opening contemplations which occurred among the traitors in this time. For while the likes of Lorgar and Erebus saw themselves as in service to chaos, but not to be consumed by a singular power like those of the Death Guard or the World Eaters, they wanted to remain servants to the undivided power of chaos. But just what that meant in itself was something open to debate. And so Layak became more aligned with the War Master in the sense that the power of chaos was something to be channeled, harnessed through more of an exchange than servitude. And although Layak was not who he once had been due to a burden that was placed upon him by Lorgar, that being holding the true name of a newly ascendant Fulgrim, now a demon Primarch, and this is a whole other story, but Layak leads a force now in service to Horus's cause to Terror. Although he has only a few thousand marines with him, ultimately he's destroyed, enabling the first demons to then breach real space during the siege. Now, I will circle back to how this frames the portrayal of Lorgar, but I felt it worth just mentioning as one of those notable breakpoints for the Wordbearers in that time, because I just want to make the point that they didn't just get tired of winning throughout the heresy, they did take their share of fractures and failures like anybody else. But the other point I wanted to make was that their losses, their failures against their wins were quite notably far apart. One of their greatest blows to the Loyalists was inflicting massive damage upon at least a fifth of Ultramar's 500 worlds in the Shadow Crusade. And again, while they took losses during the engagement upon Kalth, its mark remained upon the Ultramarines forevermore. So the devastation they inflicted there was massive. The Ruinstorm then also had become this all-impenetrable wall at the most critical juncture of the heresy, so that after all was said and done, the Wordbearer's legacy remained embedded within the Imperium, impossible to erase or expunge for pretty much all time. At the smaller scale, remnants of their rituals, their cult structures, would endure long after the traitors were driven into the Eye of Terror. So in terms of unity and hierarchy, the Legion really survived pretty intact. The Primarch lived, admittedly in isolation, but rumours still swirled at a potential return for Lorgar amid a vast army of wordbearers. And that certainly would be an interesting turn of events, not least due to Gilliman's newfound interest in the Lactitia Divinitatis. And I pray for the day we get a meeting between the two of them, although if the Lion and Gilliman still haven't got it together, I'm not sure how likely it would be that Lorgar and he would in the coming, let's say, decade. Even that is probably very optimistic. Anyway, so it's this legacy of a legion that survived better than so many others, coupled with them having personally achieved much of what they set out to, that leaves me to see the Wordbearers as these sleeper victors of the Horus Heresy. Horus fell, and the traitors failed in attempting to seize control of Terra. The Emperor lived, albeit now as little more than a husk of his former self. So does that mean that any gains by the Wordbearers amounted to not much? Sure, potentially. It wouldn't be too difficult to make that case, from the perspective that, although they performed their duties, all was ultimately lost. Within that thinking, any small or personal goals thereby then just become irrelevant. But I think that depends on if you're looking at the Heresy as this very binary situation, an ultimate big picture perspective when all totals are combined. Is it win or lose? I think when you follow the entire story, in seeing the extremely complex web of affairs and personal agendas which collectively combine to weave the Heresy, binary it really was not. It was far more granular and nuanced than that, even if from the perspective of the downtrodden citizen or guardsman who had seen just entire worlds burned from orbit, it may well have seemed very much an all-or-nothing scenario. But of course, this is a factor of the galaxy. Inquisitors see things differently than a lowly hive peon. And so within the Heresy also, there remained a far greater stratification of winners and losers. It's very arguable that the persistent presence of the traitors since the Heresy has been due in large part to the actions of the Wordbearers and indeed the success of Chaos in the long term. For they continue to be the architects of fate. They remained one of the few to not fracture after the Heresy, which enables them significant theoretical power as a unified force, not to mention they were already one of the larger legions at the time of the Heresy, second only to the Ultramarines. They also retain a unified command structure, with technically Lorgar above all, but they're commanded by the Dark Council of Sicarus. Of course, they do not fight as a legion, but in smaller groups of hosts, commanded by a Dark Apostle. These are effectively Wordbearer chaplains, but Chaos Lords can also command, and unlike the strict doctrine of Gilliman's Codex, a Wordbearer host can vary from as little as a few hundred marines up to several thousand, depending on the task at hand. Abaddon was of course the one credited with uncovering the necessity to control the power held within Blackstone, Noctilith, which led ultimately to the fall of Cadia and the forces of Chaos to push toward Terra thereafter. Yet I personally consider that the Wordbearers were also long-time experts in warp resonance, demonic binding, the exploration of the metaphysics between the warp and reality, similarly in a somewhat adjacent sense to the Thousand Suns. So it seems likely both had an understanding of warp interaction with reality. And so while Abaddon, and swear I nearly said Abaddon, was the first among Chaos to really take solid steps to either destroy or use Blackstone to their own end, it seems beyond implausible that this could not have occurred without the thousands of years of exploration and understanding that came from the likes of the Wordbearers and, yes, the Thousand Suns, those with interests in the esoteric warp matters. Because in the time of the Crusade, there was that general exploratory awareness of psychic nature, some sense of humans' binding relationship with the warp and other materials in terms of how they interacted. It certainly wasn't isolated to the Wordbearers, but I think many of those who had taken a keen interest in spiritual affairs and the power beyond reality, such as Lorgar and Erebus, were very obviously starting to reveal the nature of such things at a more fundamental level, one that would then empower their future schemes throughout the millennia. And if they hadn't have done that, I really question whether those like Horus or Abaddon would really have had the presence of mind to do so. Post-heresy, the Wordbearers are largely concerned with spreading the seed of chaos through cults, or enabling power through ceremonies and ritual, finding artifacts and so on, all of which is done at a pretty obscene scale. Very often the true scope of their goals remains very difficult for Imperials to grasp until it's far too late. Whatever they see occurring on a world is likely not what they are actually trying to do. They've also aided and unified with other traitors like the Iron Warriors, the Alpha Legion, the Black Legion, and they still seek to enable the power of the Void wherever they can to serve the gods. But unlike some, they welcome the accompaniment of demons within their ranks. They see this as a natural part of the service to chaos. And many will perform rituals even before a battle to ensure that demons stride into battle alongside them. Even so, it is the gods they serve. And so demons are seen just pretty much as fodder for the enemy, much as cultists are, and the general swaths of human material thrown against an enemy to simply waste their focus. So for the Wordbearers in M41, the long war of attrition against the Imperium continues, and as Erebus espoused, the old games never really ceased. In truth, only the players changed. The path of heresy begins with the Wordbearers at the inception of the Great Corruption. For quite uniquely, they were the only legion already ideologically committed to the pantheon of chaos. For the most part, anyway. Because compared to all the others who had rumblings between their Primarchs and this growing dissatisfaction with the Emperor, that was an ocean of discontent between the definition of a loyalist and a traitor. Within this, of course, were also those wedge of recruits who hailed from Terra, who now so grated against those taken from the Primarch's homeworlds. The Wordbearers' commitment to the powers of the Warp came as a result of the Wordbearers' and Lorgar's rebellion not being due to the more plain opportunism or resentment toward the Emperor seen among other legions. It instead came from their more deeply embedded hunger for religious conviction. Lorgar had long espoused divinity in the Emperor, and infamously, when the Emperor rejected that worship, Lorgar took the wrong lesson from the burning of Monarchia upon the planet Kerr, which was of course enacted by Gilliman's Ultramarines. And because everybody always asks, this is chronicled in The First Heretic, which is an excellent novel for a variety of different reasons, and for one, it gives an amazing perspective of how Space Marines are seen by ordinary humans. After Monarchia, Lorgar's closest advisors, including obviously the likes of Corpheron and Erebus, both veterans of Colchis's priest caste, guided their Primarch toward the entities of the Warp. The origins of this, though, lie deep in the personal history of the three. During this period of malaise, after the Emperor had crushed their spirit, finally a chance emerged for Erebus to reveal to Lorgar those gods who would not diminish his faith. To finally reveal the true faith he had kept within him since his earliest days as a member of the Covenant. For Erebus had never truly abandoned the original religion that existed upon Colchis, those who worshipped the so-called powers. So that when the Wordbearers finally returned to the galaxy, it was with a new agenda. And now it was Erebus, not Lorgar, nor Corpheron, who was at the centre of it. Because Erebus knew that his moment of destiny had arrived, and he would enable the manipulation of the War Master and those other elements that began to twist the mechanisms to fulfil their ultimate goal of initiating the heresy. Thus, their victory began before even the war itself, before any Astartes lay dead at the hands of another. The Wordbearers had already marked a significant score for their cause from the very outset, at which point it seems appropriate to interject with a lens aimed a little more upon Erebus. because no matter how despised as one of the most despicable and corrupt figures in this time, and indeed through to M41 he may be, he remains an undisputed master of fate and manipulation. As first chaplain of the Legion, his word carried significant weight, and far more so than Corpheron at this point in time, whom Lorgar had always been compliant toward in his youth. But as the Crusade and Heresy descended, and thereafter, Corpheron became something of a ridiculous figure, too old for Space Marine adaptation, and only catered to it at the request of Lorgar. Corpheron was always seen as not truly one of the Ascended, because he wasn't, and it wouldn't be until far later, with the full transition to Chaos and the power it wielded, that he was able to become a figure of powerful sorcery, and certainly as capable as any Astartes. Nonetheless, he still remained something of an outsider. Erebus, on the other hand, as a figure, survives in almost every chronicle of the Horus Heresy, but never as a frontline commander, for he was certainly no Ralgeron or Sigismund, more like those of the Alpha Legion, to which the Wordbearers share perhaps more strategic association than any others, because Erebus had learned since his earliest days how to manipulate others, twist them to his will, and if necessary to embrace destiny as it was presented, to eliminate those who got in his way or simply that he wished to end. Erebus was born on that same world to which Lorgar found himself upon, Colchis, and he shared the same harsh reality of those he would spend the coming 10,000 years alongside. Colchis was a barren desert world whose culture was built around religion and zealous faith. And I do highly recommend the Primarch series novel of Lorgar, Bearer of the Word. Because surprisingly, despite it spending massive amounts of time essentially with Lorgar wandering the desert, I found it to really reframe and help in understanding just what the Wordbearers are all about at a fundamental level, far more so than the actual heresy illustrations of them in, say, the destruction of Monarchia. We see the relationship between Corpheron and Lorgar in this time. We see their journey, their struggle, and it underscores all that would come later. It also leaves you truly hating Corpheron. Erebus is no exception in that regard, but to be clear, he doesn't appear in the book. And that's because Kor and Lorgar exist to wander the desert as these zealous nomads in this early period. Meanwhile, Erebus grew up elsewhere on the world, in what is described as the Covenant of Colchis. This was an ancient priesthood that had basically consumed the planet in this religious worship, and under the veil of all the dogma and worship is what they call the Powers. Now, it's unclear if the majority or even senior members of its structure truly understood what it is that they were worshipping. It's even more bizarre to me that when the Emperor finally arrived with everybody, that he couldn't sense that there was something going on there. Nonetheless, I think this was the case why across many worlds through the Heresy, and it may well in fact be another reason why the Emperor just flatly outlawed religion, was because so many of them could potentially have a tendency to lean towards worshipping some kind of power if they discovered it, which of course is a gateway to Chaos. So it makes a lot of sense when you think about it that many human worlds could just be indirectly or inadvertently worshipping Chaos through the Crusade, just religion which evolved upon a world and then ended up finding out that actually through certain actions they could be empowered, albeit at a very minor level. Now, on Colchis, there's no explicit references made to the likes of Khorne or Nurgle. It's just a more general sense of these powers. And so, if you're the Emperor, why take the risk in really worrying about that stuff at all? Just say eliminate them all and be on the safe side. What was clear, though, is that Erebus was a deeply troubled individual from the outset. He was never corrupted, never plied with promises of power and immortality. He wasn't twisted like Horus. He never had tools laid out before him by which he would be able to bring down a great enemy or some undeserving leader. Erebus simply was who he was. He was an evil individual from the very beginning. And I know I've discussed about that topic of what is evil and what is right or wrong in the past, but I think Erebus definitely falls into the category of true evil because he has this innate corrupting darkness within him right from the very beginning without any influence of any others. His early life, his whole life, was a lie, but also none of it was a lie. His life was a very strange masquerade that was entirely true but entirely false. From his childhood, he showed a gift for deception, manipulation, cruelty, the understanding of power through belief. His parents had advised him to follow more closely others in his city, in the Covenant, other children, that he might perhaps gain a small step up for himself in the world if he was more like some of those others which seemed more committed to their studies. To which he found another student who was appreciated by many in their local community. Another child was named Erebus. Taking the advice of his parents entirely too literally, rather than just following the example of this boy Erebus, who wore complex religious markings across his skin from the scripture of the Covenant that he studied, the boy, who we have not the name for, thought it far easier to simply become Erebus. And he did this by just murdering them and then abandoning his own family. His own name is lost to time, and now he is Erebus. He leaves the city and of course eventually finds Lorgar and Corferon. To which this is a great example for me to remind once again that short stories in 40k often contain absolutely pivotal information. They shouldn't be sidelined, you should look into them. The early life of Erebus is revealed to us in the short Child of Chaos, which I highly recommend. So now, when Lorgar's personal crusade reached Colchis, the Covenant is overthrown. It had already been fractured in a schism for some time across the planet anyway, but Lorgar had developed his own outlook. And when the Emperor came to their world, the Covenant had really fallen. This perfectly fitted in with what Lorgar had long thought to be true, that a singular figure was here now to pour their faith into. Many of the older priests just bent the knee to the Emperor, others hid their true allegiance. Erebus was among them, and never really did he believe in the Emperor. After their ascension to Astartes, Erebus, who had never truly been a strong individual in any real sense, found himself now not only with this ideological focus and strength, but now an incomprehensible sense of physicality and power. He felt rewarded for his chosen path. It confirmed everything that he was doing correctly, that his destiny was here. And in the early years of the Wordbearer's compliance campaigns, Erebus served as a priest officer under Corferon. But despite being well studied himself, Cor always represented something more like the raw zeal present in the Wordbearers, the political ambition, whereas Erebus truly, in the most pure sense, embodied the intellectual side of faith. He was consumed wholly by his belief. He never deviated from his original allegiance to the powers, which were of course the Chaos Gods. So when they came into the Great Crusade, Erebus studied Imperial culture, not to connect and join with it, but to understand it and learn, as they had done upon Colchis, how best to exploit populations and individuals as a tool for spreading their new scripture under Lorgar. Erebus, as ever, saw in the Emperor's vision an opportunity to exploit. His later persuasion drew the Primarch into those first rituals that would awaken the ruinous powers' acute interest in humanity. So really, from the point where the Wordbearers turn after Monarchia, Erebus functions as Chaos's foremost missionary. He mastered the Book of Lorgar, he committed its verses to memory and tattooed sections of it onto his skin as living scripture, as he had done previously upon taking the persona of Erebus. He founded the ranks of Dark Apostles, ensuring that every company of the 17th carried both weapons and liturgies into battle. But his plans were far greater than merely structural adjustments to the ranks of the Legion. He sought for Chaos and they to dominate a galaxy, that the powers would need more than just worship, they would need champions and rituals on a scale never seen before. And this is where Erebus, the master of the heresy, emerges. He engineered the situation which led to Horus laying wounded upon Davin. and Erebus who brought the Serpent Lodge priests to the War Master's side there. He had discovered the planet long before and understood its significance as a place of chaos worship in the ancient period, that the dark powers resided here. He'd instructed the priests to build their temples anew, and so by the time they returned, it was Erebus who guided the ritual which placed himself into Horus's spirit consciousness before the entities of the warp, convincing him that the Emperor planned to ascend to godhood and abandon humanity. That all they had fought and bled for was in service only to the Emperor's own empowerment. They would be erased from history post-Crusade, and Horus would later say that the gods spoke to him. But it was of course truly Erebus who had translated their whispers into such powerful words. That situation with Horus is one that I've talked about before when it comes to bootstrap paradox scenarios, because from that deception, the heresy was born. But the heresy itself and Erebus's involvement would ultimately lead to a moment at the end of the heresy, which also created it. The Lunar Wolf, Garviel Loken's murder by Erebus, would echo in the warp. For as Erebus described, only the most spiteful and offensive acts create such resonance, thereby creating a demon that Loken himself had faced multiple times throughout his life during the Crusade and heresy. And that was a beautiful arrangement that Samas, the demon, was one of those first demonic spirits encountered by the Astartes in the Crusade in Horus Rising. It was the first book which saw him speaking through the Imperial Vox the words, "Samas, that's the only name you'll hear. Samas. It means the end and the death." It's a nice embellishment of the series' completion that this first encounter in the first novel also was the bookend to title its conclusion, and that of Loken's journey. So it's all very cyclical. It's also interesting to consider how Loken told Malkador that his destiny was on Terra, not Titan, and it returns us once again to this concept that the likes of Kurz, Sanguinius, even Erebus, were all aware of that sense of certain actions and placements being unmovable. That while some moments in history and time are flexible, others are set, and nothing appears able to shift them. Another interesting point in this is also the fact that Malkador tells Loken Horus will destroy him, which of course he does not. During the heresy itself, Erebus's role was constant, yet despite his status relatively unseen. He accompanied Lorgar during the Shadow Crusade, and we can largely presume his serving as the Legion's primary ritualist, considering he basically created the Ruinstorm. Corpheron was left with the more practical matters that in the greater scheme of things held far less weight. For the Wordbearers and Lorgar, but more especially Erebus, the heresy was not viewed as this definitive action against the Imperium. It was merely the first crusade of a new faith, which of course would be exactly what happened as they transitioned into the post-heresy era. Abaddon's many black crusades were often assisted or facilitated by the Wordbearers, and that speaks to their great plan, their collective success out of the heresy. While battles may be lost, their overall strength is in persistently undermining and enabling destabilizing forces to pick away at the Imperium. Erebus unusually served as a long-term spiritual advisor to the War Master's inner circle, but even then, many, of course, view him with some skepticism and trepidation. But it speaks to his character and strength that he was able to decouple himself from the larger Legion forces and Lorgar to do so at all. He was heavily involved in the planning of the Isvan massacres. He summoned the Ruinstorm, as I just said. He manipulated so many other Astartes to their inevitable demise. Even those of his own Legion, who he saw as being problematic to some future event, he eliminated. It was not his ego, though, which is certainly unusual among so many of the powerful Astartes. When it comes to Erebus, it's much colder than that. It's about his strength of self-belief, which causes him to push too far. So when he blames Horus for failing his plans for Sanguinius and the Blood Angels at Cygnus, as we recently discussed, Horus flayed the skin from his face as a lesson as to just who was in charge. Erebus, though, remained in the background toward the end of the heresy also, but still carrying out notable acts, not least infiltrating and engaging Erda, the perpetual mother of all Astartes, an extraordinarily powerful Psyker, but still managing to kill her. He would pacify and aid Abaddon in attempting to reach and assist Horus in the final battle, but still too late. His final act, as we just noted, was the murder of Locan, to the outrage of Abaddon. After the war, Erebus' power only grew. He and Corpheron became the de facto rulers of the Wordbearers during Lorgar's self-imposed meditative exile. The Dark Council is founded on Sicarus, governing the Legion's empire within the Eye of Terror. The relationship between Erebus and Corpheron is very strained. It's a situation of tolerance. Less is known about Corpheron's perspective, but Erebus certainly views him as a ridiculous figure, never a true Astartes, far out of his depth, and he noted that if Corpheron was gone one day, he would still miss him, for the Legion has few jesters. But through to the contemporary Imperium, Erebus has led numerous Dark Crusades, personally conducting large-scale demonic summonings, using sacrifice and ritual to overwhelm Imperial defences. He remains, as ever, both the direct and indirect architect of word-bearer strategy, twisting others, manipulating campaigns to recover relics and unleash demonic entities. And the word-bearers very regularly seek out artifacts which hold power, such as the Bacchus Ring, which is detailed in the Dawn of Fire book Gate of Bones, which again, highly recommend that one. Anyway, circling back to the heresy and word-bearers' actions there. As they return to the galaxy after their public disgrace by the Emperor, they would be present at Isvan, of course, and the Shadow Crusade in Ultramar, where they fought alongside the World Eaters, devastating hundreds of worlds, raising temples, cults, amid the ruins which Angron's Legion left burning. Despite the plan for the Ruin Storm, though, Lorgar's deeper aim was to transform Angron by orchestrating a ritual massacre which ended with Angron's ascension to demonhood, which in itself was a masterful display of the Wordbearer's mastery of fate and warp sorcery, their devotion to the gods, and a marker for the type of actions that they would seek to replicate through the coming 10,000 years. Later, of course, at Kalth, Erebus led attacks which ruptured reality itself and thereby birthed the Ruin Storm, which was a warp storm which was so vast it entirely severed Ultramar from Terra and trapped Gilliman's Empire and other loyalists for not just that moment of criticality in the heresy, but indeed many centuries. Thus, the Wordbearers had secured one of the most consequential strategic victories of the entire heresy. Certainly not something easily achieved either, and that is another masterful execution of deceit and power. Lorgar evolved, as did all the Primarchs, but especially through the heresy. In its early years, he was an active general and a theologian of chaos. He spent more time in the warp than in the material, and he came to this perspective that chaos required mortal faith to achieve permanence. Moreover, that those in the mortal realm should serve with humility rather than demand power from those within the warp. These are all the kind of ideas that I've discussed previously when we looked at what would happen if chaos ruled the galaxy. How would you maintain this permanence of worship which is required? So where Magnus saw chaos as a tool of knowledge and Horus a means to imbue himself with power and dominance, Lorgar saw themselves only as conduits, vessels, to enable the will of the powers within the warp. Now perhaps, quite understandably, not a very popular view, and such disagreements made the Wordbearers something of a difficult legion for others to engage with beyond superficial supporting roles, and of course also led to Lorgar losing faith in Horus as the Warmaster, and this is where we see the weakness of Lorgar displayed. At Ulanor, Lorgar had planned to unleash this psychic assault that would stun and enfeeble Horus before having Zardu Lyak, who I mentioned earlier, use the enslaved to his will, Fulgrim, to finish off Horus. Then the Wordbearers and the Emperor's children would wipe out the Sons of Horus, leaving Lorgar in control of the traitor war effort. Masterfully deluded plan, and a catastrophic failure. There is another human perpetual whose story is quite weaving and complex, and I don't want to get into, but basically they informed Horus of this coup prior. Lyak, suffering from having to carry that weight of Fulgrim's binding, also strayed now and became loyal to Horus. So now Lorgar's left alone, and the Warmaster brutally batters him into submission. He's baiting him to fight, he's shouting at him, "Fight me, come and have me," but Lorgar would not go for it. After that, he just retreated largely from the heresy, and it was the likes of Erebus and Lyak who saw things through to the end. Now that's a very brief summary, but it's an entirely personal perspective I put forward here. I really dislike Lorgar's portrayal as being so very weak in terms of combat. It's true that potentially he's not this master of physical combat such as Rus the Lion or somebody like Fulgrim or Horus, but he's still a Primarch, and I think his portrayal as so weak unnecessarily diminishes people's sense of him. For example, when empowered by Chaos, he was able to vaporize enemy Astartes just by looking upon them, which is wildly powerful, and Lorgar has been as much an architect of empowering Chaos as Erebus, just in different ways. It's said that Lorgar could potentially return, and I really think we need to see an ascendant Lorgar who's fueled by the combined powers of the warp, for he serves no one god and exists to channel their will. To me, this should surely make him extraordinarily powerful, perhaps not physically, but certainly with his psychic abilities. And again, if you know the backstory to Lorgar, his life was as painful as any other, with the exception perhaps of Angron and Kurz. But his mastery of the academic in terms of theology must surely count for a lot in a galaxy where faith has become one of the ultimate powers. And I won't spoil it as I called it out earlier, but this is highlighted perfectly in a scene in Gate of Bones. Anyway, Horus was slain and the traitor host fled as the scouring descended upon the galaxy. The Wordbearers withdrew, as ever, in order, not a rout. They regrouped on Sicarus, a demon world already consecrated by their faith, but unlike the fragmented warbands of other legions, they maintained a functioning chain of command. Their sizable fleet was damaged but not destroyed, and Lorgar forbade pursuit of vengeance and ordered them to enter into a quite sensible period of reflective contemplation. The withdrawal from reality in this time preserved both the Primarch and the Legion, for the long war now beckoned them all. Now, despite the dramatic title, this is really just a conclusion to all we know. But I do want to say, if you've never really studied or invested time into learning about the Wordbearers, do so. You go and read Dark Apostle, Disciple, and Creed, First Heretic. You read Bearer of the Word or Know No Fear, and then still see if they don't make you immediately feel different, if not literally falling over yourself to create a Wordbearer's army. There is a fire in their spirit, in the darkness of Erebus, that you don't see in others. It's that purity. There is this sense of something which appeals much as it does with their opposing forces in the Ecclesiarchy, like the Templars or the Sororitas, which is highly captivating and it fuels the imagination. Simply put, I've just long felt for them to be not so well understood because they are so less present than the likes of the World Eaters, the Iron Warriors, the Death Guard, and so on. Their intentions are generally more nuanced and controlled. You don't hear about their insanity like you do with the Night Lords. But overall, their destructive potential is so much more. And I like the way they engage and interact with ordinary humans and cultists at a more, I don't want to say even level, but they do understand that there is this connection between the two, and they don't see them as always something to just needlessly slaughter. When the fires of the heresy burned out, most traitor legions, as outlined at the beginning, were left crippled, hunted, or internally destroyed, both practically or systemically. For the Wordbearers, the end of the heresy marked the beginning of a new and perhaps even more important chapter, the proliferation of faith in chaos. And in many ways, in the aftermath of the heresy, this had already been achieved on a scale none could have imagined, certainly not among those strange cults of lost worlds or the likes of the Covenant upon Colchis so long ago. As noted, one of their greatest achievements was just Legion cohesion. Lorgar was not destroyed in combat or transfigured mid-war like Fulgrim or Angron. Instead, he withdrew. Now, admittedly, not tactically and somewhat in disgrace, but nonetheless, taking his legion into the Eye of Terror, intact. Essentially, they consolidated the Wordbearers to save them for a future reckoning, a reckoning which now appears ever more likely to actually happen. And of course, the Legion followed this order with their religious sense of discipline. They retained within this their clear hierarchy with Lorgar as the Primarch and the Prophet, Corpheron as the Dark Cardinal, and Erebus as first among their priesthood. This was also highly unusual for such a structure to have survived the war without splintering into petty self-interest or plain disintegration through chaos. The same most certainly could not be said for the likes of the Night Lords, the Sons of Horus, and as I said earlier, even the World Eaters or the Death Guard. Though numerically strong, many lost coordination and really any possibility of ever running some kind of structured domination over the galaxy should that ever begin to become feasible. Only the likes of Abaddon, once he has really pulled everything together, is capable of that. And again, probably Perturabo, but again, he's sort of out of the picture similarly at this time. Basically, most of the other traitors are just not really in any shape to maintain some sort of dominion over chaos, leaving them then as little more than just troops in the long war. But all of that is just the practical. The more profound achievement for the Wordbearers was the ideological victory. Horus, destroyed or not, the Emperor's original vision for humanity had been absolutely obliterated. His dream of a secular human civilization was in ruin, and where once religion was forbidden and gods considered myth, by the end of the heresy, this vision was as dead as was possible. Billions of humans, imperial citizens, refugees, soldiers, had witnessed demons firsthand. The faith, which until now had been just stirring underground, now became inevitable. For the purposes of this discussion, I'm opting to take the Emperor's plans at face value and presume that this wasn't some grand plan for him to become steadily empowered through worship, and that the resulting faith-based Imperium would have been absolutely abhorrent to him, just as it is now to Gilliman. So the Imperial cult, which emerged in the aftermath and the scouring, canonizing the Emperor as a divine being, this cult regarded chaos still as heresy. But it nonetheless validated Lorgar's original belief that humanity was a species that required gods. Not to mention the many, many representatives of faith in the coming millennia who would be so very easily manipulated, twisted to doom entire worlds. For the willpower of mankind remains ever weak. So the 17th Legion has succeeded in scoring the most stinging victory of all. It wasn't about the physical body of the Emperor. It was in proving him wrong. And really, the basis of my entire argument today is that this colossal shift cannot be overstated in how devastating it redirected the course for humanity. The Wordbearers, Lorgar and Erebus were largely the singular architects of what happened. All the others were either manipulated or just fell into line as they saw how things were moving, or they had a sense or drive to achieve power. All of the other Primarchs really wanted to be the Warmaster or wanted to bring down the Emperor. Lorgar didn't really care about any of that. He just saw this vision for where things needed to go and just facilitate that by any means necessary. So that now, in M41, entirely comically, the most powerful institution in the post-heresy Imperium is the Ecclesiarchy, and it owes not just its existence but its entire identity due to Lorgar's first script in the Lectitio Divinitatis to the Wordbearers, which is of course just wildly comical. Their actions and scripture made faith central to imperial identity. Lorgar's rebellion against the Emperor's atheism ultimately ensured that humanity could never be godless again. So post-heresy and even in defeat, the 17th Legion ironically defined the Imperium's blueprint for the coming 10,000 years. Lastly, and I think not to be considered any less important, the Wordbearers achieved what I think is best described as the formalization of Chaos worship. Because before Lorgar's conversion to darkness, the ruinous powers were something which remained quite abstract, scattered, and locally worshipped in different ways to varying effects, like we talked about earlier with the demon Samus. The Astartes don't really know what that is, and so nobody really would have any idea about how to connect with it. Whenever they encounter cults or bizarre groups of worshipping mythology on planets, they don't really know what that's directed toward. What the Wordbearers did was unify these disordered, incompatible beliefs into a model of organized theology, the pantheon of Chaos Undivided. And that spiritual amalgam allowed worshippers to reach the void no matter their practices, something that could surely only benefit then the cohesion of the cause. While other legions were tying themselves to a single god and then fighting among themselves, the Wordbearers were stalwart in their alignment to the totality of warp power. It is in fact a defining feature of the Wordbearers also in battle, their faith, their trust that they're carrying out actions in the right place, in the right time, and that makes them an unmovable force, because they believe live or die, they are where they are supposed to be, doing what they are supposed to be. And that's not entirely dissimilar to that same trait among the Death Guard of just marching forward, this steady, unbreakable wall of discipline and identity, but for both entirely different reasons. Beyond the worship and creation of cult cells within Hive cities, the Wordbearers are also responsible for introducing the very concept of summoning, that of binding warp entities through ritual rather than just random possession, which again, I feel like you need to realise the scale of that achievement in the galactic context and how it benefits collectively the traitors. For as strong as the legions may have remained, their pairing with the demonic extensions of warp energy into reality makes them this force to be reckoned with, and not just a material issue to be steadily ground into submission or destruction by throwing billions of guardsmen at. Their new home planet of Sicarus grew into one of the greatest demon worlds, rivaling the plague planet and the planet of the sorcerers. The Wordbearers established their own empire through their unity and the Dark Council, which surely gives them more legitimacy and influence beyond just their own individuals. It's why even within the anarchic politics of the traitors, their authority as priests of the pantheon persists. And you often see Wordbearers are present at campaigns and actions of others where their understanding and relationship to the void casts them here as arbiters of ritual power. And no matter how much others may seek to diminish them or belittle them, they still are present and embedded there because the other traitors know that they are an essential tool. And so when the Black Legion begins its unification efforts under Abaddon, the early Black Crusades I think you could well attribute to the Wordbearers' impressive scale of survival, which meant that they were readily able and available to collaboration between the Wordbearers and the Black Legion fleets, providing rituals necessary for warp navigation, demonic binding, and so on. So from purely a strategic perspective, the Legion's comparative strength from many millennia post-heresy was considerable. An exact number is very difficult to rely upon, but some estimates suggest them to be near pre-heresy levels. Perhaps realistically, we could speculate them to have something like 60-70% of their original Legion strength, which is still incredibly powerful. And any such figure would make them out to be one of the most intact traitor legions. And now, with Lorgar and Erebus still in positions to lead them, the prospect of this to the Imperium should be absolutely terrifying. Because, unlike so many others, the Wordbearers never questioned their purpose. Any defeat was interpreted as divine will, with a far more important event taking precedence over whatever their personal scale engagements were. Lorgar's teachings and any derivatives became the foundational scripture of chaos worship, providing meaning to what could so easily become a more decadent or abhorrently nihilistic state among the traitors. And even among the Primarchs, weak as he was, in many ways Lorgar alone was able to remain physically and spiritually intact. Of course, we can't know what form he now takes, having ascended to demonhood. His return is, for myself, one which should bring an earth-shattering impact to the Imperium, for with their collective strength one can only imagine the holy war that would descend. Perhaps this would be the truest engagement ever seen for the Sisters of Battle, for potentially they alone, alongside the likes of the Templars, could carry the strength to resist and counter the unholy strength carried alongside the banner of the 17th. I think ultimately, the point of the success and strength of the Wordbearers, for me, is not singularly about how they exited the heresy. It rests upon the fact that in the millennia that followed, Lorgar's influence is felt through prophecy and scripture rather than direct warfare. Something that really no other traitor Primarch achieved, because despite his isolation, the seeds sown by he and Erebus and the 17th could harvest the power that then lay in the cults across the galaxy, the corruption of mortal humans and their precarious beliefs. And this is often seen when Imperials capture ordinary humans, many believing themselves to be doing the right thing, but in fact they're working on the behalf of imposing actors and agents of the 17th, which speaks a lot to the general ignorance present in the Imperium and regards to the warp, just as it did for the Astartes during the Crusade. Across Imperial space, the Wordbearers have persisted at every turn, because belief spreads far faster than fleets and is embedded far more stubbornly than any contagion. The faith which was once outlawed so violently by the Emperor has now become this universal, inescapable reality for those within the Imperium of M41. The Wordbearers, for me, are the ultimate victors when it comes to the traitors. They avenged Monarchia. They unleashed 10,000 years of spiritual and religious worship across the galaxy and enabled the great pantheon of gods to become near permanently embedded into the soul of humanity, even more so than it ever had been. They fulfilled near every internal objective they had set out, even those at a more personal level like that of Erebus. And while others may have landed more dramatic or singular conflicts which left the Imperium bleeding, or in some other state of complete physical devastation, like Cadia, no other traitor legion achieved such a combination of results as the Wordbearers. For while their battlefield victories were undeniably few, their Primarch, weak compared with so many of his brothers, their unbreakable will and ideological principles remained impenetrable to any weakness or contamination. So where many of the other traitors had to improvise, adapt, guess, and spend too long soul-searching for their new identities and direction, trying to piece themselves back together after the devastation of the heresy. In stark contrast, the 17th Legion ended the heresy much as it began, decisive, defiant, completely unified and driven by an all-consuming fury of zealous conviction in their beliefs and their Primarch. They act out every moment in full confidence, and it could never be otherwise in their mind, for the gods direct and position them precisely where they need to be. Lorgar's isolation is nothing for them to be concerned with. They understand that he awaits the moment when the great powers desire him to be deployed once again, as do they all. And that time is surely approaching with a troubling inevitability from the eyes of the Imperium, when the Dark Legion of the 17th will march forth from Sicarus, then surely those who worship the false corpse god emperor will understand the true meaning of will and power. For Lorgar and Erebus never seek glory for themselves, only to enact the purest direction of the dark gods of the warp. For they and the word bearers are, in the truest sense, chaos incarnate.